Welcome back to Hemingway's reading list. I'm just trying that out because I'm pretty sure that's what this podcast will become in a couple of months' time. Hemingway's list? Hemingway's reading list? Which one has a better ring to it? Project Hemingway. That's cool. Welcome back to Project Hemingway. Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace. The first piece in the puzzle of Project Hemingway. Who doesn't know what I'm talking about here? I'm considering at the end of the year kicking on with this project by reading the rest of the books in a list of books that Ernest Hemingway wrote down as I think it's 16 books that you must read if you are going to be a great writer. An aspiring writer asked him that advice, which books must he read? Hemingway wrote down 16 books, I think it's 16. One of them was War and Peace. Let's read all of them. Alright, we are up to book 12, chapter 11. From Prince Shurabatov's house, the prisoners were led straight down the Virgin's Field, to the left of the nunnery, as far as a kitchen garden in which a post had been set up. Beyond that post a fresh pit had been dug in the ground, and near the post and the pit a large crowd stood in a semicircle. The crowd consisted of a few Russians, and many of Napoleon's soldiers who were not on duty, Germans, Italians, and Frenchmen in a variety of uniforms. To the right and left of the post stood rows of French troops in blue uniforms and red epaulettes, and high boots and shakos. The prisoners were placed in a certain order, according to the list. Pierre was sixth, and were led to the post. Several drums suddenly began to beat on both sides of them, and at that sound Pierre felt as if part of his soul had been torn away. He lost the power of thinking and understanding. He could only hear and see, and he had only one wish, that the frightful thing that had to happen should happen quickly. Pierre looked round at his fellow prisoners and scrutinized them. The two first were convicts with shaven heads. One was tall and thin, the other dark, shaggy, and sinewy, with a flat nose. The third was a domestic serf, about 45 years old, with grizzled hair and a plump, well-nourished body. The fourth was a peasant, a very handsome man with a broad, light brown beard and black eyes. The fifth was a factory hand, a thin, sallow-faced lad of 18 in a loose cloak. Pierre heard the French consulting whether to shoot them separately or at two at a time. In couples, replied the officer in command in a calm, cold voice. There was a stir in the ranks of the soldiers, and it was evident that they were all hurrying. Not as men hurry to do something they understand, but as people hurry to finish a necessary but unpleasant and incomprehensible task. A French official wearing a scarf came up to the right of the row of prisoners, and read out the sentence in Russian and in French. Then two pairs of Frenchmen approached the criminals, and at the officer's command took the two convicts who stood first in the row. The convicts stopped when they reached the post, and while sacks were being brought, looked dumbly around, as a wounded beast looks at an approaching huntsman. One crossed himself continually, the other scratched his back and made a movement of the lips resembling a smile. With hurried hands the soldiers blindfolded them, drawing the sacks over their heads, and bound them to the post. 12 sharpshooters with muskets stepped out of the ranks with a firm, regular tread, and halted 8 paces from the post. Pierre turned away to avoid seeing what was about to happen. Suddenly a cracking, rolling noise was heard, which seemed to him louder than the most terrific thunder, and he looked around. There was some smoke, and the Frenchmen were doing something near the pit with pale faces and trembling hands. 2 more prisoners were led up in the same way, and with similar looks these 2 glanced vainly at the onlookers, with only a silent appeal for protection in their eyes, evidently unable to understand or believe what was going to happen to them. They could not believe it because they alone knew what their life meant to them, and so they neither understood nor believed that it could be taken from them. Again Pierre did not wish to look, and again turned away, but again the sound as a frightful explosion struck his ear, and at the same moment he saw smoke, blood, and the pale, scared faces of the Frenchmen who were again doing something by the post, their trembling hands impeding one another. Pierre, breathing heavily, looked round as if asking what it meant. The same question was expressed in all the looks that met his. On the faces of all the Russians and of the French soldiers and officers, without exception, he read the same dismay, horror, and conflict that were in his own heart. But who, after all, is doing this? They are all suffering as I am. Who, then, is it who? Flashed for an instant through his mind. Sharpshooters of the 86th, forward, shouted someone. The fifth prisoner, the one next to Pierre, was led away, alone. Pierre did not understand that he was saved, that he and the rest had been brought there only to witness the execution. With ever-growing horror and no sense of joy or relief, he gazed at what was taking place. The fifth man was the factory lad in the loose cloak. The moment they laid hands on him, he sprang aside in terror and clutched at Pierre. Pierre shuddered and shook himself free. The lad was unable to walk. They dragged him along, holding him up under the arms, and he screamed. When they got him to the post, he grew quiet, as if he had suddenly understood something. Whether he understood that screaming was useless, or whether he thought it incredible that men should kill him, at any rate he took his stand at the post, with waiting to be blindfolded like the others, and like a wounded animal looked around him with glittering eyes. Pierre was no longer able to turn away and close his eyes. His curiosity and agitation, like that of the whole crowd, reached the highest pitch at this fifth murder. Like the others, this fifth man seemed calm. He wrapped his loose cloak closer and rubbed one bare foot with the other. When they began to blindfold him, he himself adjusted the knot which hurt the back of his head. Then, when they propped him against the blood-stained post, he leaned back and, not being comfortable in that position, straightened himself, adjusted his feet, and leaned back again more comfortably. Pierre did not take his eyes from him and did not miss his slightest movement. Probably a word of command was given and was followed by the reports of 8 muskets, but try as he would, Pierre could not afterwards remember having heard the slightest sound of the shots. He only saw how the workmen suddenly sank down on the cords that held him, how blood showed itself in 2 places, how the ropes slackened under the weight of the hanging body, and how the workman sat down, his head hanging unnaturally and one leg bent under him. Pierre ran up to the post. No one hindered him. Pale, frightened people were doing something around the workman. The lower jaw of an old Frenchman was thick with a moustache, trembled as he untied the ropes. The body collapsed. The soldiers dragged it awkwardly from the post and began pushing it into the pit. They all plainly and certainly knew that they were criminals who must hide the traces of their guilt as quickly as possible. Pierre glanced into the pit and saw that the factory lad was lying with his knees close up to his head and one shoulder higher than the other. That shoulder rose and fell rhythmically and convulsively, but spades full of earth were already being thrown over the whole body. One of the soldiers, evidently suffering, shouted gruffly and angrily at Pierre to go back, but Pierre did not understand him and remained near the post, and no one drove him away. When the pit had been filled up, a command was given. Pierre was taken back to his place, and the rows of troops on both sides of the post made a half-turn and went past it at a measured pace. The 24 sharpshooters with discharged muskets standing in the centre of the circle ran back to their places as the companies passed by. Pierre gazed now with some dazed eyes at those sharpshooters who ran in couples out of the circle. All but one rejoined their companies. This one, a young soldier, his face deadly pale, his shako pushed back, and his musket resting on the ground, still stood near the pit, at the spot from which he had fired. He swayed like a drunken man, taking some steps forwards and back to save himself from falling. An old non-commissioned officer ran out of the ranks and, taking him by the elbow, dragged him to his company. The crowd of Russians and Frenchmen began to disperse. They all went away silently and with drooping heads. "That will teach them to start fires," said one of the Frenchmen. Pierre glanced around at the speaker and saw that it was a soldier who was trying to find some relief after what had been done, but was not able to do so. Without finishing what had begun to say, he made a hopeless movement with his arm and went away. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. "And that will teach them to start fires," says the Frenchman at the end there. Although we all know that the fires were caused by the French and the Russians and everybody. But I think, really, if the blame had to lay at anyone's feet, it would be the French. The good old last minute skin of your teeth escape by Tolstoy there. You think that that's the stuff of the new action movie, you know, Die Hard, Lethal Weapon, that kind of thing. They escape at the very last second, but hey, Tolstoy was doing the very last second escape way back in the 1860s. Pretty cool. What a scene, hey? Waiting to be executed, only to find out at the very last second that you're off the hook. And then that grim bit at the end there where Pierre could not look away from that last young man being executed. We also saw that the French executioners, the riflemen, well, it seemed that they were pretty shaken up about the whole things themselves. There's a lot of adrenaline and fear, and I understand that part of being part of the rifle range, the shooting squad, what are they called? Whatever it's called. Is that no one person in that lineup of gunmen can be blamed for the murder. So they all sort of are off the hook guilt-wise, conscience-wise. None of them feel like they shot the gun that killed the person. They all feel like it was a collective thing. It's a weird quirk of the human mind, I suppose. Turtle Vader said, "What a bleak chapter." Pierre pulls away from the factory worker when he clutches at him, but runs over immediately after the boy is shot. Why? Well, I think it's a little bit like he was thinking he was about to die, right? Pierre was. And then he finds out he's off the hook, but the other guy isn't. Well, at that point, are you going to gamble that? The guy's clutching at him. If Pierre tries to do something heroic in this moment, it's just going to get him put up on the lineup as well, isn't it? Most likely. And I think that's what he's scared of, and that's why he pulls away, because he sees the fate of this young boy and realizes that he's been spared, and suddenly this boy is trying to pull him into that fate as well. Pierre, you could say it's a cowardly act, and it probably is, but it's also one of those flight or flight gut reactions, which, as shameful as it is, you really can't say that you know you would do different in the same circumstances. And then he runs up to the boy after the execution. I keep saying a boy. Is it a boy? I think it was a boy. A young factory worker. He runs up to him afterwards because he feels terrible, and I suppose because by this point he feels safe. He feels like the shooting is over. Original CJ5 said, "It's pretty clear that the French soldiers were not happy with the executions, but carried them out without any serious protests. I can't wait to find out where this order came from, and if the person faces consequences, because Napoleon clearly wanted to rule Moscow mercifully." I think I would have done the same in regards to pulling away from the boy clutching at Pierre. He feels for the boy, but he wants to save himself first, which is why he pulls away from him. Caucus Tree asks, sorry, I dropped my pen. Caucus Tree asks, what made them stop at Pierre? We know he was distinguishable as gentry, but the others, by the others. What did the worker expect of him? Could he have interceded at some point and taken charge of the situation as a sort of almost Frenchman-like person? If anybody was ill at ease with the task and unreliant in its authority, it makes it a carpe diem situation for the right hero. What kept Pierre from stepping up? Well, could he have saved him? That's the question. Could he have saved him in that moment? These guys had their orders. They clearly didn't want to be doing it, but they were. The gunmen, the executioners. I think Pierre was just thanking his lucky stars that it stopped at him. And then the guilt. I think the guilt of pulling away was immediate, and that's why he couldn't look away when the young worker was shot. Who Was Once Delight said, this chapter was so grim and sad that I couldn't even be relieved for Pierre. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't feel relieved either. I really thought this was going to be Pierre's end. I thought we're getting close to the end of the book. Pierre's a goner. And Who Was Once Delight, I agree. I don't feel relieved. I mean, I'm glad he didn't die. I am relieved in that sense, but I don't feel like this sense of relief. I'm not sitting here going, oh, thank God. That all turned out all right. That was pretty awful. Who Was Once Delight continued, I would like to think that I would refuse to carry out orders to execute anyone, but of course my life is fairly comfortable in that I've never had to pit my survival against my morals. So it is easy to imagine myself taking the high road. In reality, who knows? That's just it, isn't it? The soldiers and Pierre are all operating in a space that we have never operated in, most likely. When you're in this life or death war situation, it's a primal part of your brain that is engaged, which is disengaged in civil life. It's impossible to imagine what you would do in this situation if you've never been in that situation, because in that situation, a part of your brain is engaged and takes the wheel that has never taken the wheel before. That's my understanding of it. So people like to think they do the brave thing, but in the moment, a different part of your brain, it's almost like a different person takes over who you've never met before. So you can't say what they'd do. I remember very early in this book, I can't remember the character, but it was a soldier, fairly important one, was tasked with riding out to the front lines of the battle and telling the troops that they were losing and that they should withdraw right now. And he was basically riding out to the most dangerous part of the battlefield to give the orders to retreat, to save as many souls as possible. He rode off towards the battlefield, got to the edge of the battlefield, and then swerved and rode away and sort of just never came back from that moment. Or did they come back later? I can't actually remember which character it was, but anyway, I remember thinking, if you had asked that soldier, is he brave or cowardly, he would have told you and believed that he was brave. But in the moment of war, of life or death, he was a coward. And why was he a coward? Because something else was taking over, right? A different part of his brain that he'd never met before. In reality, who knows, says Who Was Once Delight. And I think that's what you've got to remember. I don't think Pierre was cowardly when he pulled away. I think that was pure instinct, pure fight or flight. But I still think he's a good person. And I think the guilt was immediate, and that's why he could not look away. The last little awful detail, and I don't know if this was a translation thing, but as they were burying the bodies, that last factory worker was twitching and moving, implying that they hadn't died yet. Is that what you guys got out of the reading as well? Because that's awful. That's awful. That's like the worst bit of the whole chapter. Eek. All right. That's going to do us for today. Thank you all very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.